the rounds in both Washington and Texas. Johnson felt his reputation had been unfairly damaged, O'Donnell says, and he was right. He was totally right. It was a mistake. And some of the insults weren't inadvertent. As Johnson's laments had multiplied, O'Donnell says, he and Kennedy had worked out a set routine for handling them. The president would first hear him out alone, and then call me into his office and denounce me in front of Johnson. "Damn it, Kenny, you've gone and done it again," or whatever the vice president was beefing about. I would humbly take the blame and promise to correct the situation, and the vice president would go away somewhat happier. On one occasion, however, a different routine was prepared, one that didn't leave Johnson happy at all. Once again, it involved Rayburn. Having to deal with the speaker on his legislative program had made John Kennedy more aware than ever of his power. Appointing his friend, the painter William Walton, to the chairmanship of the Federal Fine Arts Commission, he had only one instruction for him: don't get me crossways with Rayburn. And he was aware also of how much Johnson needed the old man, and of how wary Johnson was of doing anything to irritate him. And when, suddenly, there was a possibility of a dispute between the two Texans, the president knew just what to do about it and worked out with O'Donnell a scenario designed for Johnson's maximum discomfiture. The potential dispute was over an appointment to an Agricultural Department commission. With little interest in Texas patronage, except for old friends who needed jobs, Rayburn had been allowing Johnson to clear all appointments for Texas. Kennedy had agreed that Johnson could do so. But he had an old friend who had been on the commission for years until he was removed by the Eisenhower administration, and he wanted him back on it. Rayburn's friend had once annoyed Johnson, but Rayburn wasn't aware of this, and in the case of an old friend, it would not have mattered to him if he had known. When O'Donnell asked if the appointment had been cleared with Johnson, Rayburn said, "I don't care, I want this fellow." Appearing some hours later in O'Donnell's office, Johnson told him that Rayburn's friend was an alcoholic who was going to embarrass the president. Added flatly, "I don't want that fellow appointed," and reminded O'Donnell of his appointment-clearing agreement with Kennedy. Saying he would have to let the president decide, O'Donnell ushered Johnson into the Oval Office, where the president, after listening to the dispute as if he'd never heard about it before, told Johnson, "Well, I'll stick by my agreement." Swiveling his chair, he stared out the window as if he had no further interest in the matter, and the scenario began to unfold. O'Donnell put his hand on the telephone on Kennedy's desk. "Who are you calling?" Johnson asked. "The speaker," O'Donnell replied. Hurriedly stretching out his hand, Johnson put it on top of O'Donnell's to prevent him from lifting the receiver. "What are you going to tell him?" he asked. O'Donnell said he was going to tell him that Johnson wouldn't clear the appointment. "You can't do that," Johnson said. "You tell him that you don't want him appointed." O'Donnell said that was impossible, that he had no power over appointments. "Mr. Vice President, it's either you or the president that's not going to appoint him, and it's not going to be the president." The president, O'Donnell recalls, was still staring out the window, enjoying the whole scene. There was a long silence, during which Johnson's hand never left O'Donnell's. Finally, Johnson said, "Well, don't call him." Telling O'Donnell to let the matter rest until he made a decision, he walked out. A few minutes later, Walter Jenkins telephoned to say that Johnson was withdrawing his objection. What was the explanation for treatment of Johnson that had such a personal edge? Was part of it, an understandable part of it, the simple fact that Jack Kennedy had been too close to death too many times to want to be reminded of his mortality, and that his vice president was, by his very existence, the most vivid of reminders? Sometimes Kennedy would bring up the subject of presidential succession in kidding terms, in what Sorensen calls casual banter. Dressing in his bedroom for a flight to Ohio that was going to be made through a storm, he said, with a laugh, to Sorensen, with the presidential valet George Thomas listening, "If that plane goes down, Lyndon will have this place cleared out from stem to stern in 24 hours, and you and George will be the first to go." And sometimes, when he spoke of the subject, there was, in Jack Kennedy's tone of voice, no banter at all. Walton, wanting the Fine Arts Commission to preserve two red brick and white trim townhouses diagonally across Lafayette Park from the White House that were about to be demolished for a modern office building, was considering combining the townhouses and making them the official residence of the Vice President. When he raised the suggestion in the Oval Office, however, the reaction was emphatic. "You think I want Lyndon listening across the park from my heartbeat? No." The townhouses were instead used for the Commission's own offices. And was part of the explanation something beyond reminders of mortality? Unlike Robert, Jack Kennedy appeared not to care that Johnson had, for years, been telling insulting stories about his father, and about him, that Johnson had called him nicknames like Sonny Boy, stories that had surely gotten back to his ears. Did he really not care? Had he forgiven, but not forgotten, India Edwards? Says Ted Sorensen, the aide who was as close to Jack Kennedy as anyone ever got, about India's statements about Kennedy's Addison's disease, that was about as low as anyone could go. There had been years, 8 years, when the young senator could not get consideration for a bill until I went around and begged Lyndon Johnson. How much had Jack Kennedy resented having to beg? Whatever the reasons for a personal edge in his dealings with Johnson, the edge, no matter how many historians and Kennedy aides deny its existence, was definitely there. Then, during the 4th of July weekend of 1961, while Sam Rayburn was back in Bonham, he felt a terrible pain in his back. Despite his failing eyesight and the way age had shrunken his body, he had been at the age of 79 in relatively good health up until then, occasionally even giving one of his rare smiles as a milestone neared for him. On June 12, 1962, he would be Speaker of the House twice as long as anyone else in American history. In January 1963, he would celebrate his 50th year, a half-century in the House, a milestone that also meant a lot to him. His decline after the 4th of July was rapid. Back in Washington, he had no appetite and began losing weight. He had cancer, probably pancreatic, no one knows for sure. He didn't want the House to see him like this. He was going to get away from here so the boys won't see me until I lick this thing, he told a friend. On August 16th, he told a shocked and silent House that he was returning to Texas for medical treatment. He didn't leave for a few more days, and during those days there was a moment Lady Bird Johnson never forgot. On the weekend of August 18th, Lyndon Johnson was in Berlin as President Kennedy's representative to assure that city of American support in a Russian-instigated crisis, and when he returned to Washington, Lady Bird was waiting for him at Andrews Air Force Base. Almost 20 years before, in January 1942, Lyndon Johnson and John Connolly had been boarding a train at Union Station for war service which would presumably take them to the South Pacific. Lady Bird and Nellie Connolly went to the station with them, and at the last moment, Rayburn said he was going too. He didn't presume to intrude on the two young couples as they said their goodbyes. He stood well behind them on a platform in the giant terminal. Lady Bird would always remember that short, blocky figure, so massive and strong then, standing, unmoving and unsmiling, grim as always, amid the tumult of young men rushing for the trains that would take them off to war, and the young couples kissing goodbye. She had never forgotten how hard this man, who could never be cheerful, tried to be cheerful to her and Nellie as, after Lyndon and John's train pulled out, he said, very gruffly, the only words he could think of to cheer them up. "Now, girls, we're going to get us the best dinner in Washington." Now, in 1961, waiting for her husband's plane to touch down at Andrews, Lady Bird happened to glance behind her, and there, to her surprise, standing on the tarmac, shrunken and almost blind, still as grimly expressionless as ever, was Sam Rayburn. "Dear Mr. Speaker," she wrote him, "as I stood by that airplane in the gray, grisly morning waiting for Lyndon, I looked up and saw you, and my mind went back to so many times and so many trouble-fraught situations when you have stood by our side. Next April is my 25th anniversary as a wife of a member of Congress. This quarter-century of our lives has been marked most by knowing you. On August 20th, Rayburn wrote back, even in this last letter, stilted and formal. Dear Bird, your note was very refreshing and highly appreciated by me. Here are the words I wrote in the first volume of this work. Although the pain was very bad that day, the hand that wrote that letter did not shake. There was not a tremor in the name Sam Rayburn. The next morning, Rayburn went home to Bonham to die. The 1942 episode, with much of the same wording, is from The Path to Power. The story of Sam Rayburn is in that volume, in the chapter entitled Rayburn. You'll still have the speaker, John Connolly had told Johnson in Los Angeles, advising him to accept the vice presidential nomination. As long as he had Rayburn behind him, he would have power in dealing with the Kennedys. Now he no longer had the speaker behind him. He no longer had the Senate behind him. He had no one behind him in Washington. Was it worse for Johnson after Rayburn died? The author once asked John Connolly. Yes, Connolly replied. Lyndon Johnson, who had devoted all his life to the accumulation of power, possessed now no power at all, and as vice president, the only power he would ever possess was what the president might choose to give him. He understood that now, understood that it was imperative for him to remain in the president's good graces. All his life, Lyndon Johnson had been as obsequious to those he needed as he had been overbearing to those he didn't, and now he needed Jack Kennedy desperately. He gave him gifts, 4 Hereford heifers, 2 with calves, all granddaughters of Real Silver Domino 203rd, Bridwell's top bull, which, he informed Jack Kennedy after a legislative leader's breakfast in 1961, he was having sent to the estate, Glenora, that the Kennedys had rented in the Virginia hunt country. A pony for 4-year-old Caroline, he suggested the name John Jr., but Jackie preferred Tex, and he got as much mileage out of the gifts as possible, telling the president he would like to be at Glenora when the cattle and pony arrived, so that, Mrs. Lincoln writes, he could see that they were in good order. And he said he would like to have a picture of Tex with all of them together, Jack, Jackie, Caroline, and him, on the White House lawn. The photo session went off smoothly, after Mrs. Lincoln had recovered from her surprise when, one morning, she glanced out her window and saw a strange pony grazing outside the Oval Office. She arranged for a photographer to snap a picture of Tex with Caroline in the saddle, Jack and Jackie standing behind her, and Lyndon holding the reins, and you could tell Mr. Johnson was really enjoying this because he strolled around patting Caroline on the head and patting the horse. Nonetheless, the gifts were not a total success. When the vice president saw Caroline in Mrs. Lincoln's office a few days later, he told her, according to Mrs. Lincoln's recollection, "I'm your Uncle Lyndon, remember? I'm the one who gave you that fine riding horse, Tex. Now remember what I told you, Caroline. I want you to call me Uncle Lyndon whenever you see me." Caroline, as it happened, already had a pony, Macaroni, whom she had been learning to ride, and a couple of uncles. Although she and the vice president often bumped into each other in Mrs. Lincoln's office, she never called him Uncle Lyndon, nor did he ever mention it to her again. As for the cows, raising cattle had not been what Jackie had in mind when she acquired a country home. She didn't know what to do with them. The first year, the heifers and their calves were pastured on a neighboring farm, but the farmer said he wouldn't have room for them the next year. And in the course of nature, the gift kept multiplying. By 1962, there would be 11 cows, and Jackie, in the process of renting another hunt country estate, had to write Lyndon a letter. "I can see myself plodding down a dusty lane, beating the rumps of a lowing herd in front of me, which is what your cows have now grown into." There wasn't going to be room for the cows on the new estate, she said, so she had 2 suggestions. Either, we give them back to you with all the new ones they have produced, or, we sell them and with the money give a present in your name to the White House. The letter was as gracious as possible under the circumstances. "It was so incredible of you to give them to us. I love animals so much I feel badly to have any that I can't care for properly. The only sad thing about having cows is the little calves you love the most always end up at the butcher. So the one thing I won't do is eat any of them, as I've loved them so much." But the message was clear. the present was being disposed of. In the event, Johnson sold the herd and with the proceeds bought a Lincoln manuscript for Jackie's White House restoration project. With livestock failing to produce the desired effect, there was an escalation to pearls. On Christmas 1961, while the Kennedys were vacationing in Palm Springs, they received presents from the Johnsons which Jackie found unbelievable. Jack is enchanted with his pearl cufflinks and has dressed for dinner with them two nights in a row, she wrote Lady Bird. As for me, a black pearl was always the most romantic, exotic piece of jewelry, which I never imagined I would be fortunate enough to have. I wear it on my little finger. Matching the gifts and extravagance was the deference. Over the same Christmas at the Johnson Ranch, a great deal of care was going into a letter to Kennedy which was edited and re-edited and then copied out by Johnson by hand so that it would seem more personal. It was a paean of praise for the president. Sitting in front of the ranch fireplace at Xmas, Lady Bird and I had many long, long thoughts. This year has been one of peaks and depths for us. The loss of the speaker, as well as many people dear to us, put many sad milestones in our lives, but there have been many joys. Never was I prouder than the day last January 20th, when I sat on the platform and heard my president rally his country to begin now. I am even prouder at the year's end to look back and see where you have been and see ahead and know where you are going. The paean swelled. Winning the peace is a lonely battle, as you have said so well, but you have inspired so many. You will win it for us all. And the letter ended with a coda of loyalty. Where you lead, I will follow, Lyndon Johnson wrote. Similar pledges of loyalty were delivered orally, for conveyance to the president's ears, to Johnson's few friends in the administration. I want you to get that point over to him that I'm not playing any games here, he told Andrew Duke. I'm sincere. I would like to be part of his team and play on the team. If he thinks I'm out playing for myself, it's not so. How can I get that through to him? And during the almost 3 years of Lyndon Johnson's vice presidency that followed the failure of his Seward campaign, the pledges were honored. All his life, since his youth in the Hill Country had taught him the horror of defeat and public humiliation, Lyndon Johnson had done whatever he had to do to avoid them, willing himself, whenever he was in trouble, to do whatever was necessary to win, willing himself into those efforts that astounded men who were close enough to grasp their dimensions, that made Ed Clark say he had never thought it possible for anyone to work so hard. What Lyndon Johnson had to do now was very hard. In a way, for this man to whom it had always been so terribly important that other men know he had power, and that they know also how shrewd he had been in acquiring it and in using it, and how he reveled in its use, few things could have been harder. But he did it. During the summer of 1961, the Washington bureau chiefs of several magazines were invited to the Taj Mahal. The scene was one they had witnessed before, during Johnson's days as majority leader. The big desk on its platform, the big man behind it, spotlit from above, doing all the talking, in what one of the newsmen, Times John L. Steele, described in a memo to his editors as a 3-hour monologue. The monologue's theme, on the other hand, could not have been more different from those of the earlier era, which had invariably been Lyndon Johnson's power and shrewdness. The theme of this one was that Lyndon Johnson had no power, that on his foreign trips, for example, he was no more than a messenger boy for the president, and that he didn't want any. Before he left on those trips, he told the journalists, I had President Kennedy write down for me what he wanted in the communiques for every country I visited. And he said he had stuck to the letter of what the president had written. He had, he said, carried messages not only from but to the president. Ayub told me to tell the president. I was taking a message for the president from de Gaulle. The startled Steele told his editors, He is, by his own words, a mouthpiece, a message-bearer, surrendering any notion that he had an important substantive impact himself. That was his attitude not just about foreign policy, but about every aspect of his job, Johnson told the journalists. All he wanted to be, he said, was the kind of vice president I would want if I was president. And, Steele wrote, that was what Johnson was, in fact, succeeding in being. There is about Lyndon Johnson these days a quiescent air, an attitude of submission to the young president. The surprise of the first 6 months of the Kennedy administration is the new LBJ, far quieter, far less aggressive, and considerably less exciting. He isn't running the Senate, he isn't running anything except his office. By every word and deed, he is the president's man. If this was a mask, it was one in which not a single crack was allowed to appear. Precautions were taken against the utterance of a single wrong word, or against a single word that could be interpreted wrongly. He announced that he would hold no press conferences, so that, as Jack Bell of the Associated Press explained, reporters would have no opportunity to get him into a position at cross purposes with the president, and for some time, except for occasions such as a return from a foreign trip, when a press conference was unavoidable, he adhered to that ban. Reporters weren't able to get him into that position in private either. In private serious talks about John F. Kennedy, there was never a hint of criticism from the vice president, wrote Evans and Novak, with whom Johnson would have such talks. The two columnists, who had seen a lot of Johnson over the years, noted that for Johnson, whose pleasure in mocking competitors and politicians behind their backs was legendary in Washington, that self-control must have stretched his endurance. Stretched or not, however, it held. It had always been so important to him that the world know he was on the inside of things, and all his life, what's more, he had used inside information, the inside story, as a tool to woo journalists and dominate conversations, vividly leaking details and anecdotes, some true, some partly true, some false. But during the Senate years he had been leaking to a captive Senate press corps that generally never questioned what he said, about policies and maneuvers and individuals. Now that changed, completely. One reporter, looking for news and feeling from past experiences that Johnson was always good for some, recalls that he made an appointment with him and rode from the Capitol to the White House and tried to talk with him about some situation, and he said absolutely nothing. This experience jibed with that of other reporters. He was maintaining a very rigorous, self-imposed silence. With his staff, or old allies from Texas, he would sometimes burst out in anger against Bobby Kennedy's latest affront, or comment acidly on mistakes he felt the administration was making. But these outbursts were very rare, and they were never about the president. Even in his most private harangues, LBJ never denounced John Kennedy, as one account says. And not only would he permit no word of criticism of the president to cross his lips, he would permit no word to be uttered in his presence. In the fall of 1961, the Johnsons, together with their daughters, 17-year-old Linda Byrd and 14-year-old Lucy Baines, moved to 4040 52nd Street Northwest in Washington's Spring Valley, into a house in the style of a small French chateau that had been owned by the Washington hostess Pearl Mesta, who had named it Les Ormes, for the big trees outside. Johnson changed the name to its English translation, The Elms, and added a heated swimming pool and piped in music. When at a dinner there, a former staff member, Mary Fish, who had been working for the State Department in Europe, repeated a joke about the Kennedys that was circulating there, Johnson told her to either quit talking that way or quit your job. It wasn't only with his staff that he acted like this. Even old Johnson friends in the Senate did not receive any signal by word or inflection of significant disagreement with Kennedy, Evans and Novak write. Looking back later on his entire vice presidency, Charles Bartlett, the columnist who was John Kennedy's friend, would write, "There was never any word that ever drifted back to Jack Kennedy of any criticism from Lyndon Johnson. There was certainly not one word, and I'm very sure of this, of disloyalty that the vice president ever uttered in terms of the president. No comment, no criticism." At the outset of his vice presidency, his silence at meetings had been a kind of sullenness, an attempt to evoke Kennedy's pity. There was more behind it now. When asked the question directly, he would say, "I agree with what the president said." He told journalists that when he was at a meeting, "I always hope that the president won't turn to me and ask, 'Lyndon, what would you do?'" The president had a terribly difficult job, he said. "There were difficult, terrible decisions to make, and there was only one person to make them, the president." Of all the types of loyalty that Lyndon Johnson could have demonstrated, verbal restraint must have been one of the hardest for him to impose on himself. For a man given to majestic displays of rage, to shouting and swearing and pounding on desktops, to non-stop monologues, Johnson's restraint was uncanny, the historian Jeff Schessel writes. His ability to suppress explosive emotions revealed a personal power few had ever seen. Another calls his vice presidency a triumph of self-discipline. Difficult though the restraint may have been, however, it never faltered. Hard as it must have been for him to honor his pledge of loyalty, honored it was. His loyalty didn't do him any good, however. Walking across West Executive Avenue and into the White House, he would enter Ken O'Donnell's office and say he would like a minute or two of the president's time when he was free, and sit by O'Donnell's desk waiting for an opportunity. But others would also be waiting. They would be put in the cabinet room or the fish room to wait. And sometimes the appointments were so closely stacked that, O'Donnell recalls, both rooms would be filled with callers, and others would be put in other aides' offices, or any place in the West Wing where a few feet of empty space happened to be available. And these callers had specific business, often urgent, with the president, matters on which he had asked to see them. He would buzz out to O'Donnell or Evelyn Lincoln to bring one of them in. The visitor would be ushered into the Oval Office as Lyndon Johnson still sat outside. Or there would be emergencies, and Dean Rusk or another State Department officer would want 30 minutes of the president's time for an urgent discussion involving top-priority national security matters, audiences that could not be denied. Sometimes Lyndon Johnson had to wait quite a long time to see the president. And sometimes, after he finally did get in to see him, the meetings weren't that satisfactory. More than once, when Johnson was in the Oval Office with the president, Robert Kennedy simply walked in and interrupted to discuss some new matter without, as one account puts it, so much as a nod of apology toward LBJ. Nor was it only the president's brother who was permitted to interrupt. Once, for example, Arthur Schlesinger, sticking his head in through the open door behind Mrs. Lincoln, saw Johnson sitting next to Kennedy's desk and began to retreat, but the president beckoned him to come in. Johnson was being treated as if he were simply another member of Kennedy's staff. He was reduced to begging, although he did it, at least mostly, through aides. "Charlie," Liz Carpenter asked Charles Bartlett, "could you get the president to check with Lyndon once in a while on matters of foreign policy that he's considering?" She said, in Bartlett's recollection, that the vice president was very frustrated by the fact that he was out of these deliberations. He felt a little bit sort of out of it, and perhaps if the president would just call up once in a while and ask his opinion, it would be a great help. Bartlett did bring the matter up with Kennedy, asking him, "Why don't you call Lyndon more often and ask his opinion?" Replying that he really should have done so more often, Kennedy said, "You know, it's awfully hard because once you get into one of these crunches, you don't really think of calling Lyndon because he hasn't read the cables. When you get into one of these things, you want to talk to the people who are most involved, and your mind doesn't turn to Lyndon because he isn't following the flow of cables." That explanation might have been valid, except that Kennedy, had he wanted to, could simply have included Lyndon as one of the people who got the cables. In any case, the begging didn't help. It wasn't simply foreign policy from which Johnson was being excluded. Consideration was being given to changing the jurisdiction and procedures of the Committee on Equal Employment Opportunity, of which he was the chairman, by an executive order. For 9 months, Schessel was to report, memos about the changes circulated between the White House and the Justice Department. At no point did a copy reach the vice president. During the administration of John F. Kennedy, Washington was Camelot. And in Camelot, the political world included parties. Johnson was always invited to formal state dinners. He and Lady Bird would be escorted upstairs to the family quarters in the White House with the evening's other honored guests, so that they could come down the staircase with the president, a careful several steps behind him, taking their pace from him, and they would be part of the receiving line, and they were invited to some smaller dinners in the White House, too, including some of the black tie candlelit dinners, the dazzling mixture of beautiful people from New York, jet-setters from Europe, politicians, reporters who are friends and Kennedy relatives, at which the crowd is always young, the women are always gorgeous, described by Ben Bradley, to which invitations were highly prized. They were invited, that is, if Kennedy was directly asked about including them. Recalls Andrew Biddle Duke, "I would get the list pretty late and see that the vice president wasn't on it and call the White House. It was often in the afternoon of the day of the party, and remind, usually it was Kenny O'Donnell, that since it was so late, the president himself would have to invite the Johnsons. And he would, and they would come." But Johnson felt just as out of place at the parties as in the West Wing. Everyone, Schlesinger, the Galbraiths, the Bundys, seemed to know everyone else so well. He didn't. And in Washington, parties are a place for conducting business. After dinner, two or three men would be holding a quiet conversation. None of the business was with him. Nobody was terribly interested in him, Duke says. Things got worse. At the third White House dinner dance on November 11th, a particularly dazzling affair which lasted until 4 a.m., and at which the champagne flowed quite freely, Lester Lannan's Society Orchestra played, and many of the 80 guests began doing a new hip-swiveling dance called the Twist. Johnson asked the scintillating Helen Chavchavadze, who, as it happened, was one of the president's mistresses, to dance, and slipped and fell on her, knocking her to the floor. It took a minute or two for him to be helped to his feet. By noon the next day, word of Johnson's fall, couched in vivid phrases, "he lay on her like a lox," one of the other guests reported, had reached Camelot's most distant frontiers, as Johnson was well aware. And sometimes he wasn't invited, and he seemed simply unable to accept that. Evelyn Lincoln picked up her phone one day to find the vice president on the line. "Mrs. Lincoln," he said, "I've just looked over some of the lists of dinners to be given by Mr. Kennedy, and on one of them I don't find my name. I wonder if you would check and see if there has been a mistake." The dinner in question was one for the president's personal friends, she was to recall. When she told Kennedy about Johnson's call, Kennedy asked, "You mean he called and wanted to be invited?" Mrs. Lincoln said that was correct. "Call and tell him that you have checked and you found that there was no mistake," Kennedy said. Washington had in many ways always been a small town, and in small towns gossip can be cruel, and the new frontiersmen, casual, elegant, understated, in love with their own sophistication, such an in-group, and they let you know they were in and you were not, recalls Ashton Ganella, were a witty bunch, and wit does better when it has a target to aim at. And the huge lumbering figure of Lyndon Johnson, with his carefully buttoned-up suits and slicked-down hair, his bellowing speeches and extravagant awkward gestures, made an inviting target. One can feel the hot breath of the crowd at the bullfight exulting as the sword flashes into the bull, one historian wrote. In the Georgetown townhouses that were the New Frontier's social stronghold, there were a lot of small parties, informal kinds, dinners that were given by Kennedy people for other Kennedy people. You know, 12 people in for dinner, all part of the administration, says United States Treasurer Elizabeth Gatoff. Really, it was brutal, the stories that they were passing, and the jokes, and the inside nasty stuff about Lyndon. When he mispronounced hors d'oeuvres as hors d'oeuvres, the mistake was all over Georgetown in what seemed an instant. His accent, his pronunciations of the personal pronoun, "I reckon, I believe, well, I'm just an old country boy," the way he slipped into saying "nigra" instead of "negro," no matter how hard he tried, his clothes, for one white-tie dinner dance, he wore to their endless amusement not the customary black tailcoat, but a slate-gray model specially sent up by Dallas's Neiman Marcus department store. All were grist for the Georgetown mill, as were his loquacity and his endless corny stories. Any lull in the conversation could be filled with a question based on his rapid descent from power to obscurity. Say, whatever happened to Lyndon Johnson? Nicknames, shorthand for that fall, were coined for him. Judge Crater, for example, after a New York City judge who during the 1920s had disappeared one day, never to be seen or heard from again. Some of the new frontiersmen had a gift for words and the terms that finally became the accepted nicknames for Lyndon Johnson in their social gatherings, Uncle Cornpone or Rufus Cornpone, were, in their opinion, so funny. They had a nickname for Lady Bird, too. So, when the new frontiersmen referred to the Johnsons as a couple, it might be as Uncle Cornpone and his little pork chop. The journalists who, as members of the in-group, were at the parties, would hear a West Winger laughingly refer to Lyndon? Lyndon who? And references to the situation would creep into print. Chapter 8. Cut. The large formal meetings that were the only ones to which the vice president were invited were becoming more and more infrequent. Regarding them as a waste of time, Kennedy cut back on sessions of the cabinet and the National Security Council. Soon the cabinet was meeting less than once a month. And with the Space Council running itself and the Committee on Equal Employment Opportunity being run by Labor Department officials, Lyndon Johnson had very little to do. He spent a lot of time at the Capitol, in the Taj Mahal, and sometimes presiding over the Senate, sitting on that dais on which, even as a freshman senator years before, he couldn't bear to sit, so removed was it from the action. Presiding often over a chamber in which a senator would be giving a speech to rows of desks, empty except for two or three colleagues. During the early weeks of his vice presidency, he would sometimes, during a speech, step down from the dais to the chamber floor and begin to make conversation with the senator. The senator would be polite, but often he would have to break away after a bit. He had other things to do. After a while, Lyndon Johnson stopped coming down to the floor, and once he came into the Democratic cloakroom, where for 8 years he had been the cynosure of senators' attention, where he had stood dispatching senators to the floor for a speech or a parliamentary maneuver, leaning over to hear as Bobby Baker or some senator whispered in his ear, senators clustered around him, trying to catch his eye. This time, when he came in, a few senators were in the cloakroom, sitting in armchairs or on the sofas, reading newspapers or chatting. He greeted them. They greeted him back. Then Lyndon Johnson stood in the center of the cloakroom for a few minutes. No one stood up to talk to him. No one invited him to sit down. One of the men who was there that day says, I don't think he ever came into the cloakroom again. His big car would take him the mile and a half back up Pennsylvania Avenue. He had a suite, EOB 274, of three rooms on the second floor of the executive office building, and his private office was high-ceilinged with ornate moldings, a marble fireplace and tall windows, which looked almost directly down across the narrow pavement of West Executive Avenue, at the side entrance to the White House, with the cars pulling up at it and the men getting out of them to hurry inside to important business. It was so close, he couldn't seem to take his eyes off it. His chair faced away from the window, but it was a swivel chair. In the midst of talking to someone, usually an aide, Buzz or Reedy or his Air Force aide, Colonel Howard Burris, he had few other visitors. Talking across a desk that was all too empty of anything that mattered, he would swing the chair around so that he was facing the window, and then jump up and stare out so that he could get a better look, a tall figure silhouetted against a tall window, looking out at the place he had always wanted to be. He couldn't stay away from it. Suddenly he would stride out of the office without a word of explanation, and you knew where he was gone to, Horace Busby says. He had no reason to be in the White House, of course. No assignment from the president required his presence. He might give O'Donnell some reason he wanted to see the president and sit there beside O'Donnell's desk, waiting for a few minutes of another man's time. The door would open. A group of men would come out, chatting, perhaps laughing with one another. He wouldn't know what they had been talking about. He might be told to go in then, or he might not. Or he would walk around the halls. This was a period in which he proceeded to hang around the outer offices of the White House, something like a precinct captain sitting in the anteroom of a ward leader, hoping to be recognized, George Reedy was to write. It was not a very prepossessing sight, and certainly not worthy of a man of his stature. And in so many rooms in the White House, it seemed there would be meetings going on, the smaller, informal conferences through which much of the business of the Kennedy administration was conducted. The halls were filled with men walking and talking together, or standing in little groups, having come out of one of the offices, and continuing their discussion in the corridors. "The White House is small," Lyndon Johnson was to recall years later, "but if you're not at the center, it seems enormous. You get the feeling that there are all sorts of meetings going on without you, all sorts of people clustered in small groups, whispering, always whispering. I felt that way as vice president." Among Johnson's assistants were men who loved him, and they could hardly bear to watch the way their chief was being treated. The adoring Horace Busby, in fact, was physically unable to bear it. Going across to the West Wing one day on some errand, he saw Johnson wandering around, kind of your obedient servant, just waiting for somebody to say, "Lyndon, would you run down and get the president an apple or something?" Just kind of exposing himself so they would notice that he was on call. And he saw what the Kennedy staffers were doing to Johnson, ignoring him. Returning to the executive office building, he went into a bathroom and vomited. Lyndon's brother couldn't bear it. "His visits to Washington became increasingly infrequent," Sam Houston was to say, "because I didn't want to be a first-hand witness to my brother's day-to-day humiliation." In the little world of Washington, what's more, everyone knew the situation, knew that Lyndon Johnson was no longer on the inside of anything. The discipline with which, during the early months of his vice presidency, he had imposed on himself a policy of silence with journalists who had previously known him as a master leaker of inside information, was no longer necessary since, as Booth Mooney puts it, he could no longer be regarded as an important news source. Where at one time influential members of the Washington press corps had pleaded for a few moments of his time, the situation was reversed now. "He used to call me. He was very lonely," Times Sidey recalls. You haven't been to see me. You haven't called me." Lonely. Pathetic. But Sidey had no reason to call him now. He wouldn't know what the president was going to do. He couldn't talk about things in detail like he used to do. Spotting Russell Baker of the New York Times outside the Senate chamber one day, he clapped my back, mauled my hand, massaged my ribs, all the while hailing me as though I were a long-lost friend and simultaneously hauling me into the Taj Mahal, where he launched into a seemingly endless monologue. Torrents of words poured out of him, on a dozen subjects. Although Baker had covered him in the Senate for years, Johnson didn't know his name. Sometime deep into the monologue, he scrawled a few words on a slip of paper and called in a secretary to take it, and Baker recalls, a few minutes later his secretary brought him back a message on another piece of paper, which Johnson looked at and then crumpled up and threw into a waste paper basket. When Baker was finally able to leave, he bumped into a friend who had been in Johnson's outer office when the secretary came out with Johnson's note. The friend told Baker that Johnson's note asked the secretary, "Who is this I'm talking to?" Aware of Baker's name or not, however, he had found a journalist willing to listen to him for a while, and the torrent of words went on. The monologue had a purpose. Its central theme was his devotion to John F. Kennedy. He put on a front. To hear him tell it, there had never been a happier second banana, never mind that the Kennedys' glittering young courtiers, the Harvards, as Johnson called them, joked constantly and cruelly about him, never mind realities. On this day, playing to a nameless Capitol reporter, he spoke of the vice presidential life as a friendship with a man he admired extravagantly. He was making it plain what the headline should say, "Lyndon Johnson utterly devoted to John F. Kennedy." But Baker, of course, recognized the truth, that Johnson knew that he was the butt of cruel humor among many of President Kennedy's people, and was trying to pretend it wasn't so, that he still counted as he had counted back in the 50s, when he was Johnson the genius who ran the Senate. "I felt sorry for him. If you had once been the great Lyndon Johnson, it was painful to be laughed at and called cornpone by people you thought of as arrogant, smart-ass, Ivy League pipsqueaks. Here was greatness comically humbled. It wasn't only newspaper men who had stopped calling. Washington was a Kennedy town now. It wasn't a good idea for Lyndon Johnson to be able to say he had been talking with you. A friend who visited him in EOB 274 says, "I couldn't believe it. I sat there for an hour and the phone didn't ring." When old allies from Texas, who, not being familiar with vice presidential traditions, assumed that a vice president would have an office in the White House, visited Washington, he was ashamed that he didn't. So he would bring that fact up himself, as if doing so made it less bad. Charlie Herring came by, and Johnson said, "You know, I feel like I've got nothing to do. I don't even have an office in the White House. Let's go out for a while." Supreme Court Justice Tom Clark of Texas, an old ally, was at home, and they dropped in on him just to have something to do. Dropping by for another visit some months later, Herring found that nothing had changed. He was completely at loose ends. He had nothing to do. He said, "We might as well get out and see the country." And in the middle of the day, they drove down to Fairfax, Virginia, to see a facsimile of George Washington's will. The formal meetings in the cabinet room, of the cabinet or the National Security Council, at which Johnson sat, in the center of one side of a long table, directly across from President Kennedy, were particularly terrible hours for Lyndon Johnson. Not just his desire, his need to dominate, but also his need to decide, his will for decision, his will to act, what Theodore H. White was to call his yearning to act, were fundamental to his inner being. But if at first his reluctance during the Kennedy administration to speak at such meetings had been a manifestation of sullenness or self-pity, or a bid for sympathy, or a desire to show his loyalty, "I agree with what the president said." Another consideration had now, with the increasingly open hostility of the new frontiersmen, been added to the list of those that militated silence. Any comment that he made in a meeting seemed to be quoted or misquoted to the press, in ways that made him seem Southern or militaristic or uncouth. "I don't want to debate these things around 15 men and then have them all go out and talk about the vice president and what he thinks," he explained once. So while other men discussed, while another man decided, Lyndon Johnson sat silent, in a role that was, like so many aspects of the vice presidency, foreign to his very nature, sat so silent that people who had watched him at meetings in earlier years marveled at what they were seeing now, at what Dean Rusk was to call the great self-discipline and strength, the self-control that enabled Johnson, with all that volcanic force that was part of his very being, to fit into that new role. Not even when the discussion turned to problems with Congress would he comment unless asked directly by the president, and then the answer would be brief. He had to sit there and observe controversies and frustrations which for years he had managed, and be totally passive, his old friend Elizabeth Wickenden points out. His hands revealed how hard it was. Sometimes, as he sat at the long table in the cabinet room, listening to other men talk, those big hands would be clasped together, the intertwined fingers working nervously, so hard that his knuckles were white with the effort he was making not to speak. Sometimes, as Kennedy, directly opposite him across 7 feet of polished mahogany, ran the meetings with his easy air of command, he would look away from the president for long minutes, staring down the length of the table, a faraway expression on his face. Sometimes he would put his elbows on the table and his head in his hands and stare down at the mahogany. Then he might raise his head and lean forward across the table, a hand shielding his eyes, as if from the sunlight streaming in the windows behind the president. At the weekly legislative leaders' breakfasts now, he rarely said a word, wrote Doris Kearns, whose future husband, Richard Goodwin, attended some of them. His face appeared vacant and gray. He looked discontented and tired. Even when, in response to a direct question from Kennedy, he offered an opinion, he tended to mumble, his words barely audible to the person sitting beside him. On rare occasions, when he was particularly excited or perturbed, he would suddenly raise his voice for a few moments to its customary shout, only to let it sink again into an unintelligible murmur. And by the summer of 1962, his predicament was in the press. For this man who so dreaded public humiliation, the specter had arrived at his front door, in the newspapers that were delivered to the Elms each morning. And waiting for him each morning at his desk in the Taj Mahal were articles that had been scissored out of other newspapers by his staff and placed in a folder for his perusal. By the end of the day, each would have scribbled across it the big L that signified that he had seen it. "Where's Lyndon?" asked a headline in the New York Herald Tribune over an article that asked, "Why has Lyndon Johnson gone into eclipse?" "Lyndon Johnson guessing game" was another headline. The article under it asked the question, "Why Johnson does not make the headlines now that he did once?" and answered it, "It is John F. Kennedy who makes the decisions and gets the headlines." In a syndicated column that appeared in scores of Hearst newspapers, Marianne Means wrote, "He is usually so thoroughly ignored that it is hard to tell if he is here at all," and noting that, in conferences, basically Johnson remains an observer, not a participant, mocked his extraordinary efforts to keep himself in check. None of these were Johnson traits before the vice presidency. His egotistical temper rarely has permitted him to share the credit for anything. Thus, Johnson appears to be working very hard at his tiny job. One aspect of the mockery must have cut particularly deep to a man to whom it was so important to be thought of as shrewd, tough, always outsmarting other men, using them, and never being used himself. Now that Johnson has served his purpose, to get Southern votes for Kennedy, perhaps Kennedy was simply tossing him aside, the Chicago Tribune speculated. And as the number of such articles increased, the headlines seemed to boil down to a single mocking question, repeated in a dozen newspapers. Whatever happened to Lyndon Johnson? On one such article, Johnson, in his agony, scribbled a note to his aide Charles Boatner. "Chaz, why? Not true." But it was true, and he knew it. It wasn't all that hard to break Lyndon Johnson. What lay beneath that blustering, bullying exterior was too fragile, had been broken too many times in his youth. Ever since those terrible years growing up in the hill country, ever since those years whose shadow never left him, any disparagement, any criticism had hurt so deeply because it was cutting into a wound too deep to have ever closed. It was most important to Lyndon not to be like Daddy, not to become what his father, once so respected, had become, the object of public ridicule, of public scorn. But the parallel was inescapable now. His father had become a laughingstock. Now, so had he. His whole demeanor showed what had befallen him, showed that the effort he was making came at a very high price, that the self-discipline it took for him to act against his nature, the self-effacement that Arthur Schlesinger says was for him the most unnatural of roles, came at a growing psychic cost. The price was registered in his weight, which was dropping off him because he wasn't eating much. Although he ordered new suits, they were soon hanging loosely on his shoulders. His trousers, which he always liked cut full anyway, bagging around his shoes. It was registered in his face, which had become gaunt, haggard, so thin that the long lobes of his ears, the jut of his big nose, the heavy black eyebrows and the dark circles under his eyes, eyes sunk deep in his head now, were more prominent than ever. And the gauntness was accentuated by his expression, so gloomy, with the corners of his mouth pulled down and the jowls hanging down, that more than one journalist called it a hangdog look. It was registered in his stride. The old, long, imperious Texas lope was gone. He walked more deliberately, with shorter steps. His shoulders were slumped. When he was in the president's presence, he seemed sometimes to be actually bending his knees a bit, as if he wanted to conceal the fact that he was the taller man. Bill Moyers, who had, within a few weeks of the inauguration, become publicity director for Kennedy-in-law Sergeant Shriver of the Peace Corps, felt that Johnson's self-confidence was gone, that he was a man without a purpose, a great horse in a very small corral. Others described the cost in terms of an image, not a pleasant image when applied to a man to whom being a man was all important. Daniel Patrick Moynihan was to recall looking into Lyndon Johnson's eyes during his vice presidency and thinking, "This is a bull castrated very late in life." Nor was it only other men who applied that image to Johnson. He applied it to himself. In later years, when the vice presidency was behind him, he would apply it jokingly. "A vice president is a steer," he would say. "You know what a steer is? A steer is a bull who has lost his social standing." But there was no joke in the way he used it now. Late one afternoon, while Sam Rayburn was still alive, Johnson walked into Rayburn's Board of Education. Instead of walking over and kissing Rayburn, as he usually did, he sat down without a word in one of the dark leather easy chairs and put his head in his hands. Then he sat there for long minutes, oblivious to the other men in the room. His head kept dropping lower until it was barely above his knees. And then, in a very low voice, Lyndon Johnson said, "Being vice president is like being a cut dog." Talking to the press was too hard. The big names had stopped interviewing him, but there were still requests, relayed to him through Reedy, from other Washington reporters or from reporters from Texas and foreign papers. "I am too worn out," he said to one request. On another, he scribbled a single word, "No." He couldn't bear to appear on television, turning down even the popular Today Show. He told Reedy to simply reply to television requests by saying that he didn't go on television. Reedy, reluctant to make this bare, almost unbelievable statement, that the vice president of the United States doesn't go on television, resorted to different excuses, but they wore thin. In March of 1962, Adlai Stevenson's press secretary, Clayton Fritchie, telephoned Reedy, an old friend, to say that the UN ambassador had agreed to host a program on outer space and international cooperation and wanted Johnson to appear on the show. And Reedy pointed out to Johnson that as chairman of the Space Council, it was only logical that he do so, and that if he didn't, Fritchie would get someone else, perhaps one of Johnson's space aides, like James Webb. Johnson told him to refuse, but instead Reedy sent Johnson a memo which he wrote and rewrote, trying to make Johnson see the folly of what he was doing. "After considering it from every angle, I would like to suggest that you reconsider your refusal," he wrote. "This program would definitely give you an opportunity to be associated with the space program, above and beyond almost anything else you could do. The spotlight would be on you." When Johnson told Reedy to say what he had been told to say, Fritchie's response was curt. "I called Clayton Fritchie and told him that you do not go on TV shows," Reedy reported. His exact response was, "All right, I might invite Jim Webb then. We want someone from Washington. I appreciate your efforts, George. So long." He couldn't bear to stay in Washington. After Kennedy's triumphant confrontation with Big Steel in April, during which, to battle inflation, the president forced the United States Steel Corporation to rescind the price increases it had announced, a four-day-long episode in which Johnson played no part, he began spending more and more time on his ranch, leaving Washington on Thursday and not returning until Monday. But he couldn't relax there. To while away the time, he played endless games of dominoes with his ranch foreman, Dale Malachek. And he couldn't sleep there either. Malachek, milking cows at 4 a.m., suddenly felt a presence behind him, and turning on his stool, saw Johnson standing behind him in his bathrobe. With the weather turning warmer in Washington that summer, he would invite Texas allies over to the Elms to swim or sit around the pool, and then have dinner. But one of the frequent guests, Congressman Jim Wright, recalls, he kept grabbing the phone impatiently and calling somebody. He couldn't relax. He couldn't keep his mind on one subject. And when he did sleep, his dreams, his nightmares, were of what Doris Kearns Goodwin, to whom he was later to recall them, called utter powerlessness, of being trapped. And the trap in which he was caught in his dreams was, in fact, the one in which, in daylight hours, he lived. In the dream that particularly tormented him, he was seated at his desk in the executive office building, so near and yet so far from the White House just beyond his window. "In the dream," he told Goodwin, "I had finished signing one stack of letters and had turned my chair toward the window. The activity on the street below suggested to me that it was just past 5 o'clock. All of Washington, it seemed, was on the street, leaving work for the day, heading for home. Suddenly I decided I'd pack up and go home, too. For once I decided it would be nice to join all those people on the street and have an early dinner with my family. I started to get up from my chair, but I couldn't move. I looked down at my legs and saw they were manacled to the chair with a heavy chain. I tried to break the chain, but I couldn't. I tried again and failed again. Once more, and I gave up. I reached for the second stack of mail. I placed it directly in front of me and got back to work. In desperation, he turned back to the staff member on whom he had relied for so many years, instructing George Reedy to draft one of his long memos, laying out a strategy to deal with the predicament. But as always, he got from Reedy the truth, that there was really no way of dealing with it. The question raised by so many newspaper men, what is the vice president doing, is not going to be answered satisfactorily by more activity or by public relations moves, Reedy told him in a memo. They are accustomed to thinking of you as the man who for 8 years was one of the dominant movers and shapers on the American scene, and this does not accord in their thoughts with the picture of a man meeting officials at the airport and going down to the White House to give advice but not to make decisions. The question, what is the vice president doing, is going to persist with unfavorable undertones until they find some area in which you are actually making decisions. And, Reedy went on, because of the inherent nature of the vice presidency, it is very difficult to put you in a decision-making role. For the time being, there is no conclusive answer to the what is the vice president doing question. We have no choice other than to struggle along doing the best we can while laying our plans for the future. Reedy was telling him that there was no way out of the trap in which he had caught himself. If, during the vice presidency's early days, a gloomy demeanor had been a pose Johnson adopted to elicit sympathy, it was no longer a pose. He began telling even his most trusted staff members that they should start looking for other jobs. John Connally, running for governor of Texas, asked Ken Ballew to leave Washington and join his staff in Texas, and when Ballew reported this to Johnson, Johnson told him he should go. "I'm dead," he said. "You follow him." His manner was particularly noticeable when John Kennedy was present, as Evelyn Lincoln noticed. As the president's sureness and independence increased, the vice president became more apprehensive and anxious to please, she was to recall. Sometimes, on the increasingly rare occasions when he was in the Oval Office, with Kennedy leaning back, relaxed and at ease in his chair, Johnson, sitting facing him in a chair beside his desk, would be on the edge of his seat, leaning forward as he talked, his pose that of a schoolboy trying to win a teacher's favor. And in the fall of 1962, in response to further humiliation from the Kennedys, he groveled even more deeply than before. In September, James Meredith's attempt to become the first of Mississippi's 1 million black residents to attend the state university was met by the defiance of Mississippi Governor Ross Barnett, touching off 2 weeks of tense negotiations with the White House before, over the last weekend in the month, the tension erupted in violence that left 2 dead and scores injured, and in the dispatch of hundreds of United States Marshals and the federalizing by Kennedy of the Mississippi National Guard. Johnson was not involved in the negotiations. During the crucial weekend, he was not even in Washington but down at the ranch. Unfortunately, that fact became known, and on Monday morning the Houston Chronicle asked its congressional correspondent, Vernon Louvier, to ask the vice president for comment. Strolling with an affectation of casualness up to the Senate press gallery, Boatner managed to get a look at the story in Louvier's typewriter. "He has written only one paragraph," he reported to Johnson, but it was to the effect that the man who carried the South for President Kennedy apparently had not been called in for discussion of the Mississippi situation. Telephoning Louvier, Johnson tried frantically for 30 minutes to convince the reporter that his information was incorrect, that in fact the White House had been constantly consulting him that weekend, that even when he had been out boating on a lake near the ranch, he had had a ship-to-shore telephone with him. But the information was accurate, and the article, which ran on Tuesday, reported that over the weekend, one of the tensest in the nation's history, Johnson was not in close personal contact with the White House. He was relaxing at his ranch in Texas. Johnson's response to the story was panic, that it might offend the president. Telephoning Dean Rusk, the cabinet member friendliest to him, he asked him to get a message to Kennedy, which Rusk did by passing it on to White House aide Dungan. The message was that the information in Louvier's article had not come from him or anyone on his staff, that he had never discussed the Meredith situation with any journalist or leaked any information that would suggest discord with the administration. And the message didn't stop there. He wanted the president to know, it said, that the situation in Mississippi had been handled better than he could have ever thought of handling it, and that he felt that he had been treated better than any other vice president in history and knew it. Then, a few minutes before 9 o'clock on Tuesday, October 16, 1962, as President Kennedy was sitting on the edge of his bed in bathrobe and slippers reading the morning newspapers, there was a knock at the door, and McGeorge Bundy came in, and under his arm was a sheaf of photographs. And the 13 days of the Cuban Missile Crisis had begun. When, at 11:50 a.m. that Tuesday, the photographs, barely discernible lines and dots that were, a CIA analyst explained, missile sites that Russian technicians were assembling in Cuba for missiles, capable of carrying nuclear warheads that would be able to reach targets in most of the United States and that would soon be operative, were shown to the group, mostly members of the National Security Council that Kennedy had assembled in the cabinet room. Johnson, as a member of the NSC, was among them. The first reaction was shocked disbelief. For months, the Russians had been assuring Kennedy that they would not put offensive weapons in Cuba. And when opinion in the group, which during the 13 days would come to be known as XCOM for the Executive Committee of the National Security Council, came down in favor of quick action, an immediate airstrike delivered without warning against the missile sites, or a broader, more massive bombing campaign or some other form of quick military action, Johnson was part of that hawkish majority. Prodded by Kennedy, "You have any thoughts, Mr. Vice President?" after he had remained silent all afternoon. Johnson said he wanted to hear the recommendation of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who were meeting at the Pentagon. But, he said, "The question we face is whether we take it, the missile sites, out, or whether we talk about it. And, of course, either alternative is a very distressing one. But of the two, I would take it out, assuming that the commanders felt that way." He would not, Lyndon Johnson said, consult with America's allies or with its senators or congressmen. "I'm not much for circularizing it over the Hill or with our allies, even though I realize it's a breach of faith not to confer with them. We're not going to get much help out of them. Tell the alliance we've got to try to stop the planes, stop the ships, stop the submarines and everything else there, the Soviets sending. Just not going to permit it." The Joint Chiefs advocated a surprise airstrike, not just against the missile sites, but against airfields and possibly other targets in Cuba, with a simultaneous build-up for a possible invasion. That evening, Kennedy ordered XCOM's members to drop whatever else they were doing and analyze his options. Action was imperative, Kennedy said. "I don't think we've got much time on these missiles. We can't wait. We're certainly going to do option number one. We're going to take out those missiles." But, he said, he wouldn't act immediately. He ordered more photographic reconnaissance flights. "We had to be sure," in Sorensen's words, "of what we were facing, had to have the most convincing possible evidence to present to the world. Had to know what else was taking place throughout the island." The president made a plea to the group for secrecy until the evidence and our response was determined. "Any premature disclosure," in Sorensen's words, "could precipitate a Soviet move or panic the American public. And if negotiations were decided on, leaks would make them more difficult. He and the vice president," Kennedy told XCOM, "were both scheduled to campaign for congressional candidates that week, and so that the press wouldn't get wind of the crisis, they would both keep those commitments until the group united behind a recommendation. Johnson was scheduled to leave the next day for appearances in the Midwest and West, and then Hawaii, but Kennedy's appearances were in the East until Friday, so he could sit in on at least some of the group's meetings." Near the end of that evening meeting, at which Johnson had again sat silent, Kennedy had pressed him, "Mr. Vice President, do you have any thoughts?" But Johnson this time declined to give any. His only response was, "I don't think I can add anything that is essential." His silence at the meeting did not, however, mean that he was silent everywhere. Despite his statement that, "I'm not much for circularizing it over the Hill," he evidently decided to circularize it to at least one man on the Hill. Telephoning Richard Russell, he told him about the photographs. "The first word about the existence of those missiles came in a telephone call from Johnson," says William H. Darden, chief clerk of Russell's Senate Armed Services Committee. Kennedy had asked that information be kept secret, and among those from whom he was undoubtedly most anxious it be kept secret were the members of the Congressional Hawks, whom he called the War Party. Johnson had given the information to the War Party's chief. That during the next 6 days, before Kennedy made the information public in a television address, it remained secret, was proof of the fact that coexisting with Russell's monumental racism was what a friend called